Welcome to the Starting SaaS Podcast. Starting a career in SaaS can be intimidating. I've been there, but it doesn't have to be. From the basics to the latest trends, this podcast will help you build a foundation and stay ahead of the curve. This is the easiest way to learn about SaaS from the folks inside of it. Welcome to the Starting SaaS Podcast. Today, I'm so excited to welcome onto the podcast Mickey Kennedy. Mickey is the founder and president of eRelease, a leading small business in press release distribution. He's an expert at helping small businesses, authors, startups increase their visibility and credibility through PR. He's a press release ninja, and today we talk about that. We talk about how to make your product interesting to journalists whenever you're trying to get picked up by the media. We talk about how to get journalists excited to talk about your product and story, what PR actually is, because there are a lot of misconceptions, why it's useful, how to use PR as leverage, this concept called newsjacking, which I loved, and so much more. So I hope that you enjoy this episode with Mickey Kennedy. Let's get into it. So I'm here with Mickey Kennedy. I'm so excited because the more digging that I did into Mickey Kennedy, his story, the content that he produces, the more I realized this man is very, very, very good at what he does. So welcome to the podcast.
Well, thanks for having me.
Yeah. So to kind of kick us into this topic of PR marketing, I thought it'd be a really, really good place to start. Just can you tell me the difference between good PR and bad PR? Because I know that like lots of people like the idea of PR, but they don't always do it well. What does it take? What does it mean to do PR well?
I think to what it takes to do PR well is to be effective and to basically try different approaches until you get some earned media, PR successes. There's a lot of PR firms that sort of just churn out pitches and they don't really yield a lot of results. Occasionally they might do, you get in a Fortune website article or things like that that are more of just like personal favors, or they have an in for things like that, but they don't really generate the real earned media that can be achieved. And I think that a lot of it comes down to people relying on basically generic milestones, the types of releases that they see other people pitching. They sort of mimic that and they don't get very creative with what they could be sending out there to the media and being very strategic. And I issue between 10 and 14,000 press releases a year. So I get to see a lot of press releases that are working and a lot of press releases that don't work. And my goal is to educate people, specifically my customers, on what types of releases they should be focusing on.
Yeah, I love that. So as a background or like a foundational thing for anybody who is not yet aware of PR, basically PR is a really, really great strategy that marketers employ to spread their content outward. So like whenever you're a marketer, you can either create content and distribute on your own, maybe distribute through evangelists in your community or your ecosystem, or you can also go to different sites, for example, and they'll publish pieces that they find interesting. And so Mickey here basically helps you make your content really interesting. And I think that's really fascinating because there's a lot here a lot of principles inside of PR that you can take just in all of marketing. How do you make content more interesting, right? Like your customer does not necessarily just want to read product specs. They don't necessarily just want to read about your features. So along that line, what are some good principles of great PR pieces?
I think some of the principles are basically providing the framework that the media needs to build a story. So many people do not realize that journalists by nature are story builders. A really good article generally has a story arc. And if you are just issuing, for example, a product launch press release and you're just sticking to the features in the press release and here's a link to purchase and find out more information. It's very little for a journalist to build a story. The types of things that you could incorporate that would make it, much more promising would be to have a use case study. Here's a problem that our industry faces. Here's a specific problem this client faced. They used it. This was the results that they achieved. Here's a quote by them. All of a sudden, there's a story that a journalist can build your product launch around. And that definitely fulfills much more of what they're looking for. And I think so many people write press releases from their standpoint. You know, we want to sell product. We want to really list the features. We want to be, forward thinking in that way. And they're just not really providing the ingredients that a journalist needs to really build out a great article.
Interesting. If I remember correctly, you have a background in creative writing, right?
I do. I have a MFA in creative writing with an emphasis in poetry. So I think that's why I'm naturally drawn to being creative and brainstorming and coming up with lots of different avenues. And, I definitely feel like that's one of my strengths when it comes to PR and why I feel it's a natural fit for me.
What do journalists want? So like whenever you are creating these PR pieces for journalists, right, you have to get in the mindset of a journalist. You have to get in the mindset of somebody who's evaluating your content, saying, okay, is this something that I can write on? Is this something that piques my interest and might pique the interest of my readers? What are those things that journalists are looking for and why? Like if you were to really sit in the headspace of a journalist.
I think that journalists are always on the lookout for something that will excite or titillate or strongly interest their audience. And I think that, there's lots of different approaches to get there. But, one thing I've noticed that works, especially for small businesses, is a human interest element. So many startups and small businesses like to just be completely corporate and professional. And yet, if you ever watch Shark Tank, you notice that the people that go on there, one of the first things they do is they introduce their story, how the product or company was founded, what obstacle they may have overcome. Maybe it was, a health issue, or they were laid off and they had a hobby and they thought maybe I could turn this into a business. And I think one of the reasons that's so powerful is that, people humanize with other humans. And, it's a great way to sort of build a really almost like a relationship through words in which you could really connect to people. And I think that, that's something that I see with a lot of startups. They do really well. They have both an elevator pitch. They know what they do that's really different from everybody else in the marketplace, but they also really know where they came from and they have a story, a lore that they've created and they pass down.
Would you consider it like a hero's journey?
Yes. I mean, yes, it's getting back to a story. The hero journey is like one of the primal stories that we have. And if you can sort of, develop, your identity and your business with that in mind, I think that you can really satisfy a lot of the story arcs that journalists are looking for and they gravitate to, and sometimes they're not always truthful. eBay, in its early years, the story was that the person who created it had done so to help his girlfriend sell her Pez collection. And it was completely made up by a PR firm, but it worked. I mean, there was lots of articles sharing that. There was probably 40 or 50 articles that mentioned that within the first couple of years of it launching. And it was something that just resonated with people. And so I'm not advocating that you create myth, but I do think that sometimes there's a few ways in which you can sort of maybe embellish in a way that's sort of truthful to the spirit of something and how it sort of came to be.
I love that. It kind of reminds me. So like I would consider journalists artists in some sense, and it kind of reminds me of like a caricature. Like you embellish one aspect of a person because just for like the sake of the art, which is really, really cool.
Yeah, absolutely.
So to go a layer deeper, like why do journalists want stories like this? What is the pull for journalists to uncover and to write stories that either have a hero's journey or that, have this human interest element? Is it just for the art, like for the sake of the art? Is it, that they have to build trust with their audience? Is it that they're trying to build an audience?
Right.
What are the factors?
Yeah, I think that to really build a strong audience and a following, you have to be a great storyteller. I can't think of anybody that has a huge following either in social media or on a blog or a news column that doesn't really craft a great story and tell, you know, a really compelling narrative that gets out there. And I think that, you know, if you look at, you know, TikTok followers that you really like, they're really generally good at telling a story and getting it out there and communicating. They have a style, and that style may be something that, you know, resonates with people. And I think that that's why journalists are sort of drawn to this, the story arc. It's very primal. We've been telling stories since probably the beginning of humanity. And I think it's a natural way in which to communicate. I've seen articles, especially small articles, you know, that get put on the wire and stuff like that, that are just all facts, and people read them to get the news. But the ones that people stick around and really read are like the multi-page Wall Street Journal articles that really build out, you know, this is the company's situation, but this is the story of how it got there. And it's usually very compelling and very interesting, and it really draws you in. And I think that's the real value of having a really, you know, story-based type approach to writing.
I love that. So the way that I kind of want to go into this is the different stages of you know, a PR piece. So like the initial stage, like, okay, I want to gain traction. I want to build, you know, brand awareness or whatever it is that we're looking for. Then, okay, now that we have somebody that's, you know, somebody has bitten, and they want to write on this. And then, like, what do you do after that? So I'm going to kind of take us through that journey and kind of get your take on how people can do this the best way possible. And I know that from your past podcasts, which are amazing, everybody should go check them out. Tons of wisdom. You seem very, very giving with all of your information. Like, you want to help people succeed. And I really, really appreciate that.
Yeah, my whole goal is to get people to try PR and really try different approaches with it. One of the things that I hate is someone who tries a press release, they do a standard press release that they see other people do and nothing happens. And, you know, and yet I know that if they are a little creative and I can give them some of those creative ideas that, you know, perhaps they can push themselves a little bit and try a different approach and one that's more likely to yield results.
I love that. Do you think that's because, like, you just have a passion for uncovering the story? Like, there's so much news out there. People just don't know how to pull the threads and uncover that story and create that story for themselves.
I think that's part of it. Also, I think it's, you know, I feel like it's almost like a puzzle as far as figuring out what the media will respond to. And I feel like if you can just be a little creative and test and try different things, you may, you know, a PR campaign is usually 6 to 8 releases. If you do, do a PR campaign, you'll probably find that like half of the releases yielded nothing. But if you do a really solid PR campaign, the other half could really yield amazing results. Like, you know, one gets 2 or 3 major articles, or one gets 4 or 5 articles, of which one might be a major one and one might, you know, a couple might be really good industry trade publications. And so it's really just taking advantage of the leverage opportunity that's out there with PR, and not knowing, and just testing and trying. And sometimes you can just replicate what works. Mm-hmm. I had a client that did a survey or study within their industry, which has now become one of my go-tos for coaching clients. And they sent it out and they got like, I think around 10 articles written about them from that one press release. And they've just do it every year now, and they're known for it. And they often get, you know, 8 to 14 articles on average every time they do a press release on a survey or study of their industry. And I think that, you know, the the reason they can replicate it is because even if you ask the same questions today of your industry, they're going to be different in 12 months time. And there's lots of also, you know, specific questions that you can ask that are really relevant, like right now. Like, are you having problems with people not wanting to go back into the office? Are you having trouble building a culture with remote workers? Are you, going to be spending more or less in the next couple of quarters for marketing that could signal perhaps, economic challenges ahead specifically for your business or for your industry?
I love that. I think that's such an underutilized approach. But the funny thing to me is that it seems as though people treat PR as like a checkbox, right? It's like, okay, well, we know that this is a marketing play. We know that we should be doing this. So like, let's just throw somebody on it. Let's tell them to go, you know, write up this PR thing, and then we're just going to send it out and try and get some bites. But what's interesting to me is that it seems as though PR is pretty similar to something like content, right? Like YouTube videos. Not every single YouTube video is going to perform well, right? Not every single podcast is going to perform well. Not every single channel or thing that you're creating is going to perform well. But if you put enough energy and attention and you actually treat it as though it's something that you can perfect over time, the ones that do perform well will have incredible results. And that's kind of what you were talking to. Like it's unmatched. What are some examples of like incredible results that you've seen inside of PR?
Well, we did one during the pandemic for a short-lived initiative called the Dining Bond Initiative. It was set up to help restaurants that were closed during the pandemic. And it was one press release that went out. We quit counting the number of publications that picked it up after 150. All the major publications, Wall Street Journal, Washington Post picked it up. All the food trade publications picked it up. So many local newspapers throughout the United States picked it up. And it also generated some international pickup as well. And, at least $10 million in revenue was collected to help restaurants that were closed, all from a single press release that, would have cost under $500 to issue. And, I challenge any marketer to sort of achieve those results for under $500. It's near impossible. And it just shows a wild example of the leverage opportunity that if you have messaging that is really on point and really relevant and newsworthy, you can really take advantage of hitting a wire and going really broad. In that case, I think it worked really well because there was so much negative news out there and the media was looking for something positive. And the second reason was I think it did so well is because people were stuck at home and didn't know what was going on. And yet here was something actionable they could do. They could support their local favorite restaurant. And if the Dining Bond Initiative was able to contact them, they could give money that would go directly to them and sort of be backed by like a gift certificate.
Interesting. You mentioned that it's a leverage opportunity, and I love that language. Love that language so much. Do you think that, like, what do you think are actually the proper ingredients to taking complete, like, using the leverage properly?
Right. I think that to use it properly, it's hard. It's easier to target widely than it is to be super targeted. We have people come to us and say, my only goal is the New York Times. And that's like such an impossible ask because, pitching them directly, you can do that one-on-one, but it's really hard to hit them at the exact moment that they want to run with. But, hitting broadly, you don't really always know how they're going to respond. And there are places that you'll get picked up that you'll be surprised at. I had a client that was in the golfing arena, and they had created, this was like over almost two decades ago, they had created an umbrella that had a attachment. You could attach it to your golf bag, and so they wouldn't get wet while you're walking the golf course. And someone came in and said, could this be attached to a wheelchair? And they're like, yes. And all of a sudden they sold out and they got a few mentions in some publications that were specific to the disability market. And it was something that they hadn't even thought of. But when you go over a wire, you know, you're accessible by so many different people, and your audience may be broader than you intended. And I've seen not just that client, but I've seen other clients over the years do pivots as a result of who in the media engaged with their product.
This is so interesting to me. So PR leverage basically exists as like you increasing the nodes. You're increasing your ability to surround your buyer, right? Like there are all of these places that are potentially mentioning you. And those are many places for your buyer to learn about you and also to build their belief in you, build their trust in you. It's interesting because everybody approaches, you know, the New York Post and these big media giants. And they're like, okay, well, we want to get inside of the New York Post. But does ICP have to do with how you approach PR firms? Does, you know, trying to decide, okay, does this PR firm have the target market that I'm trying to go after? And how does somebody determine that? Because I don't know, or I guess this is a question for you. Do you find that people just kind of spray and pray with PR firms? They're just like, okay, how can we get our news into whatever news source possible?
I think that when people work with PR firms, most PR firms are a little specialized. And I would probably steer clear of ones that are more generalist because, you know, a PR firm, they live and die by their Rolodex. And generally, it's hard to have a Rolodex that encompasses the entire media world. And so they're, you know, that's why there's usually people who are fashion PR professionals or technology, or they may be specialized within the tech world with different types of verticals that they work with. And so I think that I would, you know, ask or look around and see who else in your industry is using, you know, look at their website, who their clients, who their accolades, you know, their wins are with. Are those the types of publications that align with you? When it comes to going over a wire, you know, there aren't really specialized wires in the US. There's really just two news wires or press releases. And we work with PR Newswire, which is the oldest and largest, and Business Wire is the other one that's also very large and respectable. There are a lot of other places out there that call themselves wires. There's a minor wire called Globe Newswire. But outside of those three, there's really not a true, they're not true wires. They might have wire in their name, but they don't have the infrastructure or the mass following of working with all the journalists. It doesn't make sense for journalists to belong to 30 different wire services. They generally have a wire preference that they is their go-to. For a lot of them, it's PR Newswire and Business Wire, and they go there and check and pull down releases in their beat. They can customize usually the feeds, so they can exclude press releases that mention certain keywords or make sure they include press releases that have certain keywords that are really specific to them. And so it makes it a great resource for them to go in there and see the types of releases that are within their industry and of which they're probably looking for. And so it's a natural place for them to sort of fish for ideas for stories and articles.
That's very, very interesting. And I know that journalists also like to develop relationships inside of companies. So like if they can develop, you know, one-to-one relationships, then they can have access to stories before they even come out. So is that an additional, not hack, but like kind of hack to getting good pieces out there?
It can be. I think that a good PR firm will sometimes, you know, give someone first bite at a press release or an announcement that they're doing. And they often know, you know, have a relationship with the media that they have a good idea of what publications would be excited by that and consider it. I think that could really work well for more newsworthy type companies. It is something that I see being utilized a little bit less and less outside of like major companies and major PR firms using, because it just gets hard to manage it. And so many journalists don't like to commit to a story. And so often people feel like, I'm going to give you first bite, but you haven't really come back and said yes or no. You're sort of, you know, wanting more information. So it makes it very difficult to sort of measure, because you if they don't take it, you want to make sure someone else has the opportunity to take it.
Interesting. So I want to take this back to whenever you're first deciding that you want to write a PR piece. What usually is an inciting incident? What is the usual thing that people are coming to you with? Is it, you know, a product spec? Is it a feature? Is it like some big news inside of their company? And how do you pull out good angles, good stories? What questions are you asking them to try and uncover the things that they may not already see for themselves?
Right. So the types of common things we get are company milestones, might be anniversary, might be a major new client. It could be a new version of a product. It could be a new product. Could be a strategic partnership with a company. Could be a speaking event at a conference. Could be, you know, someone new to the board or a major executive. That being said, we do get a lot of releases sent through us that are personnel changes, and they're usually not the executive level. They're usually like someone, you know, like associate in HR. And it's always frustrating because people are paying money to send that over the wire, and the media is not really going to respond well mm-hmm. to that at all. It's not really strong news. Maybe the local paper might do a small mention, and maybe a trade publication might put a couple sentences on the move. But outside of that, it's really not where I would recommend people spend money to go over the wire with that type of content. So that's where I get into educating people on what types of releases are worthy of going over the wire, and, things along those lines, like, doing a survey or study, or doing a product launch and incorporate a use case study. Maybe something about, your story, your path. Sometimes you can incorporate that in, to something else that you're announcing, but you're also including the history of the company. So, there's lots of different approaches. Being a contrarian is really a great way, to sort of stand out, against so many other people in the industry. There's a concept that came out over a decade ago called newsjacking. And it said, if there's a hot trend in your industry, send out a press release with your adding, you know, your opinion on it. And it's usually everybody saying the same thing. And it may have worked 10 years ago. I'm not even sure it worked then, but it certainly doesn't work now, because if there's a hot button item that everyone's talking about and you're saying pretty much the same thing everyone else is saying, you're not going to get much coverage, if any. But if you are the one person saying the opposite of what everyone in the industry is saying, you stand the chance of being plugged into every article on that subject, because journalists like to be fair and balanced. And often they go to print with only one side because no one raised their hand and said, hey, I would like to point out some negatives here. Here's some cons to this argument. Take electric cars, for example. Everybody seems to believe that they're our savior and we really should be embracing them and they're going to save the environment. But if you were a contrarian, you could, you know, come in and reasonably argue that, hey, maybe we shouldn't be adopting these so fast. We haven't solved the mining of these minerals, which is really environmentally, destructive. There's the labor issues of mining, a lot of it done by people who are on the lower rungs and sometimes children. And also, we haven't solved what we're going to do with these batteries at the end of their life. Are we creating an even larger problem in landfills with all of these batteries? Not to mention that sometimes it takes 25 to 30,000 gallons of water to put out a fire when an electric car is involved. And so that's a way to be reasonable and level-headed, but also pointing out the contrarian side on the subject. So anytime someone is talking about the electric car, they might want to put a couple sentences that you've said into it. And that's a really great way, I think, to sort of stand out. There's also, people are always looking for predictions and trends, especially, seasonally. And if you're out there, providing great content and, top trends or, top 10, certain things, those often will get picked up because journalists are just like, I have a little bit of space here. Here's, you know, someone published the top 10 small business marketing podcast list, and they recognized a couple of them. It's good enough for them. They just copy and paste and will run with it. And so that's a really great way. If you are a small business marketing podcast, put yourself in there as number 7, surround yourself with other people that are really well known, and you would be surprised the number of publications that will just take that top 10 list and reuse it and get it out there.
That's really, really fascinating to me, that more people don't take the opportunity. It's like you have lots of companies who are posting really great content on their blogs, on their own channels, but they're not looking to leverage PR. They're not looking to leverage the potential of getting this content dispersed across the ecosystem, for example. So how would somebody do that? Like, let's say Play by Play. They have this narrative. It's a strong narrative. It's a contrarian viewpoint, and they have lots of contrarian ideas. How are they going to be putting their content or framing themselves as a subject matter expert in this contrarian way of thinking so that journalists can find them? And so journalists can use their words and their thoughts.
I think that, doing a series of releases where they sort of talk about the contrarian viewpoints about something, I would recommend putting not just one quote in the press release, but two or three thoughtful quotes. And quotes are really one of the most powerful elements of the press release that often get overlooked. So many quotes come out looking like they were just written by consensus. They're safe. They don't say anything meaningful. But if you have a quote that is just a really strong quote, and it's really hard to define what that is. Sometimes it could be the creative flourish by which you wrote, or it could be the way you said something so powerfully and succinct, or just, the overwhelming forcefulness and emotional element in the quote. But anyhow, the real measure of whether it's a good quote is if you took it out of the press release, would there be a loss? And if there would be, and you just paraphrased, then you know that it's probably a good quote that can stand on its own. A journalist can then build an entire article around an amazing quote. And I have seen, small companies get mentioned in articles that are just major articles, like in the Wall Street Journal, just because they had such a fascinating quote and they said something in a way that was just like, wow, that's really insightful. And I think that by putting out releases with those kind of thoughtful quotes in there and positioning your viewpoints are a great way for journalists to find out about you, put you on their little short list when next time they're doing a story on that subject matter. And if the press release already has two or three ready to go quotes, they can just copy and paste those quotes when they're working on a story, and probably won't even have to reach out and call for an additional quote on the article.
That's really interesting. Do you think that companies believe that they can individually drive more eyeballs to their own content than they actually can?
I think that people feel like they can control the eyeballs to their own content. And I think that one of the things that a lot of people don't like about PR is you don't really have that sort of granularity and the measurements that you have. For example, if you send paid traffic to a page, you can usually use tracking URLs. You can monitor the conversion rate on your website. You control a lot of different elements. And so I think that a lot of marketers avoid PR because they can't really control a lot of the elements. They don't necessarily get to put a tracking URL out there if it gets picked up. Often journalists, if there is a tracking URL, they'll just restrict it to the actual website or the actual page without that tracking ability. So it makes it a little bit more difficult for a marketer to respect and really like PR, because it is challenging in the matter of control. And I think that a lot of people really hate to give up that control out there. And it does make it a little difficult to sort of measure PR successes. That being said, one of the great things about getting earned media, getting articles written about you, is that you get that sort of social proof, that, you know, almost an implied endorsement when a journalist writes about you. And that ability of credibility gives you customers that come from that article that are usually not price sensitive. They usually read an article, they have this goodwill that's created, and they want to do business with you. And a lot of my clients find that the customers they get through that are amazing lifetime customers. Mm-hmm. That being said, you can take that same article and you can repurpose it. You can put that link on your social media. You can send it out to your customers. You can send it out to your leads. There's always people who are in your lead pipeline who are probably going to decide not to use you. Maybe they get to 49%, but they have to get over 50% of the argument for them, you know, to be won over. But maybe getting their article and reading it will create some of that goodwill and drive them over that and convert them. I had one customer who did so well with the media, and it was all the wrong kind of media. They were a carpet company in New Jersey. And the media pickup that they got, and they were very happy with, was in their industry. They were trade publications of where the subscribers are other carpet companies nationwide. And but they were able to put all these clippings at the end of the year. It was more than 30 clippings. And they started giving them to their sales staff. And every time they went out to someone and gave them a quote for a new carpet installation, they would say, "Hey, we may not come in the cheapest, but you're not going to find anyone who's as well respected as us. We've been picked up at the local newspaper, New Jersey Magazine, and here, Floor Trade Weekly, this trade publication." And they would just sort of thumb through it for a few seconds with the client. And they started converting 17% of these at-home consultations just by using that brag book. And that just sort of shows, you know, these people didn't read the articles, but they saw them and they saw the headlines and the publications they were with. And they immediately got that credibility boost and that authority that comes from earned media. If you came into someone's home and showed them, "Oh yeah, we've advertised on a few of these places and here's our ads," it's not going to impress them. But when you have people choose to write about you, that is just a huge boost. And it's really hard to replicate that with any kind of marketing.
I love this. So in your opinion, has earned media become more important recently in the past, 5 to 10 years, where I would say we have tons of noise and it's really, really, really hard to separate fact from fiction? Everybody's saying something, everybody has an opinion on something.
I think so. I think that, a lot of people are suspicious of, review websites and the numbers. I mean, even on Amazon, people are really skeptical of reviews, but yet for a lot of people, that's all we have to go on. And so, we use those. One of the tricks that I use is I look at the one stars. And if a product doesn't have at least a few one stars and two stars, I just don't believe it. And, I don't, that's what works for me, but that's just psychologically something I've created. But yet when it comes to having articles or reading an article, it feels like I can trust this and I trust what's written by a journalist. And I think that, journalists do a pretty good job of balancing, responsibility. And I think that they're seen as, respected members of the community or of a particular industry. And as a result, I think that a lot of people feel that when someone writes about you, that you've been vetted. And, and that's just that rapport, that signal of trust is just really powerful.
That's interesting. I think it's probably understated how important the fact that journalists have their name tied to a piece actually is. So like people can hide behind companies, right? Like you can hide behind a company profile and it doesn't mean as much, but it's interesting because as for example, as media becomes more and more, they, you know, people can put out content with AI faster and easier, is people, like people, their opinions, and the fact that journalists do have a level of responsibility. Like if they put something out that is not quality, somebody will come back to them and say, okay, well, this was not quality and this is why I did not like this. And I think that's actually really, really interesting. Yeah, would love to hear your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I think that, you know, it even plays out with, you know, social media influencers, that we have certain people that we respect what they say. And we also have those that we see who just, you know, hype a product mm-hmm. that's sponsored, and we discount that. And I think that having, you know, people in print or online who we respect and have an affiliation with or appreciation to, I think that those it's natural that we want to follow people who are seen as leaders or teachers. And so many journalists are seen as in that respect. You know, there are a lot of people that I've followed over the years with sort of tech columns and, you know, in Macworld and stuff like that, because I'm an Apple guy. And I really respect that. So if I'm searching for a new printer and someone's written an article recently about that, and I see that it's someone that I recognize, I'm going to trust what they say and forget the reviews on Amazon or other places that I'm just so suspicious of, because there's so much curating of reviews that happens online that it's just really, it throws up my blinders and I get really suspicious.
Yeah, that's really interesting. It's odd, kind of. So you mentioned like marketers and the way that marketers have gone to market in the past, where it's like, we have all these numbers, we have all these ads. We know that if we put in a certain amount of money, we get a certain amount of ads and we get a certain percentage of clicks and whatnot. And it's interesting because, number one, the numbers are going down. So recently, marketing has not been as effective as it used to be. And number two, marketing like that is not the only way to market anymore. And it wasn't to start with, but like whenever SaaS became big and everybody started seeing these new opportunities for growth, they got excited. But it's kind of like this move back to the community, back to humans, back to like the individual. And it's interesting to me because, PR does that. Like PR is really, really cool in the fact that you can spread content around many, many, many different places, right? Like if say 10 news sites pick you up, that is 10 more people that are in a sense endorsing you, endorsing your content, endorsing the things that you're doing, the things that you're saying. And yeah, it's really, really interesting to see that it's kind of like brand, right? Like people kept on talking about brand, and though ads are important, though growth marketing is extremely important, there are some things that are more qualitative, like brand, like PR, that you can't entirely measure, but that still have an immense impact on a business and on the trust of the people who are coming into and trying to decide whether or not they're going to buy from the business.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. So really quick, I wanted to go back into the whole like process of building a PR campaign. So you have this idea, you want to build it. Are people coming to you with fleshed out ideas, or are they coming to you primarily with some sort of a hook? They're like, we want eyes and to build attention around this thing, help us to do that. And then you have to pull it out of them.
A lot of people come to us with finished press releases. Okay. And they are looking for press release distribution platform, so that we know that we don't have a lot of control over that first release. And so we usually, you know, take that order, send it out, and then we've pushed a lot of education on them.
Okay.
As to, hey, that was a great first release that you've done with us. Here are the types of releases you really should be considering going forward. Here's some ideas specifically for your business. And we really try to sort of coach them through the types of releases that they should be doing, you know, from that point. And with some successes, but we also work with a lot of different people. So a lot of people are sort of streamlined in their flow, and they're responsible for a lot at a company. And one of the things they're assigned is just do a release every once in a while. And they usually have a specific subject and they just run with it. And that's okay. But I think that the people who are going to have the most meaningful experiences and the best experiences with PR are those that are willing to challenge themselves and test different types of releases and try ones that are a little more strategic and a little more meaningful.
I love that. And how do you coach people to do that? So let's say that somebody has this idea, they want to run with it, and you see the potential. Like there's immense potential within this PR piece, but they're not highlighting it. How would you deal with a situation like that?
Well, one of the first things I do is I have a free masterclass that teaches different PR strategies, and I try to get people there and to go through that. It's an hour long video masterclass. It really goes through a lot of the high level types of things that journalists are looking for. For example, numbers and data. One of the things that you can do to really boost up a regular press release is to put some numbers behind it. And you'd be shocked at the types of numbers that are out there already publicly available in your industry that no one's really using in a creative way. So, you know, for example, your product or service probably addresses something in your industry that's a deficiency. Mm-hmm. Can you get numbers about that deficiency? So all of a sudden, rather than say, here's our product, but you could point out like, you know, 67% of businesses in our industry fail in the first 5 years because of marketing. And specifically, you know, how they handle their leads pipeline. And we've generated a product that does it. And it's like, wow, that really makes it more concrete. And it seems like it's much more specific news rather than just you qualitatively saying we're addressing a concern, a weakness in the industry. And, you know, the introducing people who've used it and what the results they've seen. You know, Company X used our product and saw a 43% increase in the number of leads that converted or something along those lines. Those are really meaningful things that journalists love to jump on because they know that it's anchor points in an article that will really speak to their audience. It's not just, you know, someone saying something, you know, claiming that they're the best or that they've solved a specific problem, but you've got numbers attached to it.
It also seems to build authority for the journalists themselves.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's interesting. So then you have this piece. It's good. What happens next? So what is the distribution that happens whenever you have a good PR piece? And then just out of curiosity, so like, when a PR piece is published in different news sites, news channels, what kind of a distribution method do you recommend? Like, do you recommend any sort of distribution strategy for the person who had it initially or like who wanted to push it out?
Right. So the way our distribution works is it's a national distribution over the wire. You get to select your industry, trade publications as part of the process. And you can do local saturation as well. And that always confuses people because, you know, if they're local, aren't they also on the national? And most of them aren't. Like there are people who are tagged, say in the Chicago area, that are only interested in Chicago metro news. They're not interested in national news. So when you choose saturation, you're targeting people who are tagged local. And so that could be valuable to add that to your distribution. It's a matter of, is the local market extremely important to you? And then it's a matter of it going out there. There's always certain things of like scheduling. When do you want to schedule the release? Used to be everybody chose Monday and then everybody said, well, Monday is not a good day. So everybody started choosing Tuesday. So now Tuesday is a really overwhelming day. So there's a lot of content out there. I find that there's no magic day. You know, publicly traded companies like to release bad news at Friday after the close of the market. And yet it's still there Monday when the news comes out, bad news, front page of the newspaper. So you aren't hiding anything. If you have some meaningful news, it'll get out there. And then as far as like, you know, what happens from that standpoint, anytime a press release goes out on the wire, it gets syndicated to a few websites. I always tell people syndication isn't very important. The release The press release verbatim will appear on a few websites. And it looks great to be on like Yahoo Finance and a few little news sites, but it happens automatically and it happens with almost every press release. So what we're really hoping to get is that earned media where someone writes an article about you. And that can take anywhere from, you know, immediately to a few days to a few weeks. And with trade publications and monthly magazines, it could sometimes even be a little bit longer. One of the tricks that I always tell people is, you know, there are clipping services out there, but they're prohibitively expensive. They usually, a good clipping service is usually $1,500 to $2,000 a month. And if you're trying to build a PR campaign for a whole year under $6,000, you're not going to be able to do that. But if you go to Google Web and Google News and do a search for, say, your product name or whatever was mentioned in the press release, like your company name, and you set the date, which you can do in advanced tools in both of those, set the date that you issued the release to now. And all of a sudden, you're only looking at web pages and news content that happened since that press release went out. And I find that that's, you know, gets a lot of it. The reason I recommend the Google Web in addition to Google News is there are several news sites who've opted out of Google News.
Interesting.
But they still show up in Google Web. And so I recommend doing searches in both of those and using the date feature so that you're really winnowing down on the types of dates that would be affected by a press release going out. Things that could happen from that is, you know, generally journalists don't generally contact you unless they need clarification or they have a specific angle that they would like to get your opinion on. They're busy. They love it when they can get all the information in the press release or, you know, on your website so they don't have to contact you and play phone tag or email tag or however that is. You know, that being said, that it does sometimes happen. It would be nice if every time they do write about you, they let you know. But it generally doesn't happen. And you really have to sort of keep an eye out for it yourself. If you have, leads come in, always ask, you know, how did you hear about us? Sometimes that can pick up places that you didn't even realize that you got some exposure on and things like that. But, really it's just analyzing, usually 6 to 8 weeks after the release went out, you know, what were the highlights, what worked, what didn't work, and sort of, you know, do a little bit of analysis of what we could do better going forward, what would be a better type of release that we could learn from.
That's so fascinating, and I'll have to re-listen to that for myself. But, and additionally, I'm definitely going to be taking your masterclass. I already told you that 100%. But, so I have a rapid fire, but one final question before we get there. So there's this push inside of marketing to market as journalists, right? And obviously PR is very, very important and really interesting and fascinating as a way to distribute your content. But what is the value of people and marketers specifically building their content, writing their content, and thinking like journalists and or a PR firm, for example?
I think that, sort of putting yourself in the mindset of a journalist allows you to escape your myopic viewpoint of things, because being a business owner or someone in your company, you have a very narrow focus. And I think being a journalist opens you up to the other opportunities that would potentially be engaging with the audience out there in the community. I think the same thing with PR firms. I think a really great PR firm, they do something that's really amazing. When they get a journalist on the phone and they're pitching them and the journalist says, I already covered that a few weeks ago, I'm not interested. They do a pivot and they've already got in their mind two or three other different approaches or angles in which the client could generate a story. And I think being really quick on your feet and not latched into one particular pitch or focus, but being able to sort of brainstorm and have in your mind ready several different options and say, okay, so you've covered that, but how about this? And then you pitch something else that's really different. And I think that, you know, that's where a great PR firm, they're like superheroes. They can just, you know, really take being shut down and create a new opportunity out of it.
Yeah, I love that so much. So inside of B2B, so I'm a marketer and I love narrative and I love stories and I love pulling these threads. But one of the things that I find so fascinating is whenever I look at the industry as a whole, it seems as though getting excited about B2B is kind of tough for a lot of marketers. It's like, okay, how do we pull out these threads? How do we pull out these stories? And for B2C marketers, for example, or even just journalists in general who are writing these pieces on individuals or like Rolling Stones features or these really, really cool pieces, it seems easier for them. But like you said, like it's actually very, very exciting. Like if you can train your mind to see all of those potential threads, all of those potential angles, get excited about B2B. It doesn't just have to be, you know, one specific narrative, one specific way of thinking about a content piece.
Absolutely.
So, moving into my final rapid fire questions for you. Let's see. So I'm going to start with, the question that my last guest left for you. So he asked, what is one lesson that you are still learning right now?
I think the one lesson I'm still learning now is to, trust my team. I am learning to micromanage less and less and really trust the team that I've built and rely on them and realize that they're getting stuff done. Not exactly the same way I do it, but they're getting it done and they're getting it done well.
That's a really important lesson to learn for sure.
Absolutely.
Especially whenever you've been the executor for so long. Like it seems as though you've been the one executing for a really long time. So then you get used to the way that you do things, the efficiency, the how you go about thinking about things and problem solving, that it's tough. And I definitely understand that sometimes.
Sure.
Second question. So you know the 80-20 Pareto principle, correct?
Yes.
Awesome. What 20% accounts for 80% of your success?
I think for me, word of mouth, you know, about a third of the people who appear on Shark Tank use us to do a press release when their episode goes out. And it's the producers of the show that recommend us specifically. And I can't put that on my website because Shark Tank is a licensed and protected brand, they said. But it is kind of cool that you have so many people who have had really good experiences or have heard great things about you and they tell others. And when we look at our conversions month to month, it's frustrating that more than half of them are unaccounted for. They didn't come from paid advertising. They didn't come from natural search. They just popped in to e-releases. And I think it's a lot of just referrals and continuing to have really great experience with customers. And they're just telling other people about us.
You mentioned earlier asking on your website and or within the early customer journey process, like, how did you hear about us? Do y'all do that? And is that usually,
we do.
Is that usually what you find?
Yeah, we usually have that they had someone mention us specifically or someone had a really great experience or someone just said, go to e-releases, don't go anywhere else, go directly there.
This is dark social in action.
Right.
Yeah, it's so interesting to me because there's so much that you cannot account for, but that matters so much. And my last question, what do you wish you knew before you started in PR, in B2B, building your companies, all the things?
I think for me, it was measuring everything. It took me 10 years to get to a point where I started measuring everything. And, you know, I then went and embraced it a little too much, perhaps. I don't know. But I would do A-B split testing of all these different processes in my business. And one was onboarding customers and gave them two different experiences.
Interesting.
And then determined if one was better than the other. And surprisingly, one was remarkably better. We used to send a wild care package to all new customers that was kind of zany, like me. And it had a lot of fun stuff in it. And it had crab chips because we're from the Baltimore, That's Maryland funny. Area. And Edgar Allan Poe figurine and all kinds of fun stuff. And a customer said they thought it was unprofessional. And rather than get offended, I just said, well, let's test it. And I did. And they were exactly right. The over 6 months, all new customers were split into two. Half got that. The other half just got a book and a welcome letter. And the people who got the book and the welcome letter, their lifetime value improved. Wow. And at the 1 year mark, the 2 year mark, and at the 3 year mark, the lifetime value of that population was three times.
Wow. What
the population was the people who got the wild package. And the wild package cost like $60. The book and letter was like under $5. So, it was funny. I was spending a lot more and yet I was creating less of an impression with people.
Wow. That is so interesting. Yeah, that's wild, but it makes so much sense. I've been learning this lesson as well from a couple of people that are my mentors. Basically, like, there are some principles that are important. So, like, within marketing, there are some principles that you cannot measure, and they're just important, like story, like narrative, but also measuring is also so important in order to prove your value, in order to make things better, in order to refine processes. And in your example, in order to stop doing the things that you probably should not be doing.
Right.
Anyways, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. This has been amazing. And I'm going to leave all of the information below the masterclass for people to go and take it, because that's a great, great resource and it's free, which is awesome. And any other links that you want me to leave below, I will leave them so that people can find you and follow you.